January 28, 1981. Bossier Parish, Louisiana. The decomposed body of a young woman is discovered in the woods next to a remote logging road. The victim has been stabbed 9 times, but since she cannot be identified, she becomes known as Bossier Doe. 34 years later, Bossier Doe is finally identified as 17-year-old Carol Ann Cole, a Michigan resident who had run away from Texas a few months before she was killed. Suspicion turns towards John Chasen, the man who reported the discovery of Carol Ann's body to the police, and would go to prison for killing another person several years later, but there is no conclusive evidence to implicate him, and Carol Ann's murder is never solved. After that, the trail went cold. Hello, everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and this week, we're going to be exploring another case involving a murder victim who remained Jane Doe for decades, the 1981 murder of Carol Ann Cole. If that name sounds familiar, you might recall me briefly mentioning Carol Ann Cole on the podcast episode I released last month about the murder of Carolyn Eaton, who was a Jane Doe known as Valentine Sally until she was identified 39 years after she was found. At one point during the investigation, a woman from Michigan became convinced that Valentine Sally might be her long-lost sister, Carol Ann Cole. While DNA testing ruled out this possibility, it wasn't long before Carol Ann was positively identified as a murder victim named Bossier Doe, who had been found in Bossier Parish, Louisiana during the same time period. Carol Ann had moved from Michigan to Texas with her mother, but ran away sometime in 1980, though the circumstances of how she wound up in Louisiana are unclear. And of course, even though Carol Ann has gotten her name back, the mystery is still only half solved, since we don't know who killed her, but this is where things get interesting. It turns out that John Chasen, the man who discovered Carol Ann's body and reported it to the police, wound up going to prison for a completely unrelated murder 2 decades later. Chasen's own daughter, who says she was present for the discovery of the body, now believes that Carol Ann stayed at her family's residence a short time before she was killed. She has accused her father of being violent and abusive, and now believes that he may have murdered Carol Ann and intentionally orchestrated the situation for his children to find her. Learning about this story on my recent episode about Carolyn Eaton compelled me to do another deep dive, and I've now decided to put together an all-new episode about this case, which has remained unsolved for over 40 years. Anyway, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word and garner us more exposure. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, including stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let us now explore the murder of Carol Ann Cole. Our story begins in 1981 in Bossier Parish, Louisiana, which is located in the northwestern portion of the state. On January the 28th, a local resident named John Chasen Sr. left on a hunting trip with his 14-year-old son, John Jr., and 12-year-old daughter, Frances, and drove them down a remote logging road off of Louisiana Highway 157. They stopped at a spot about 2 miles from the highway, and the two children got out and started exploring the woods, but it wasn't long before they stumbled upon a heavily decomposed body, which had been concealed by large branches. After the Chasins drove back to the residence, John Sr. phoned the Bossier Parish Sheriff's Office and agreed to meet them at the spot where the body was located. After the Sheriff's Office arrived at the scene and examined the victim, they determined that she was a young white female who was estimated to be between the ages of 15 and 21 and may have had Native American ancestry. The level of decomposition had rendered her face completely unrecognizable, but investigators were able to determine that she had straight and shoulder-length blonde hair, was around 5'5 or 5'6, and weighed between 125 and 140 pounds. She had been stabbed a total of 9 times in the back and chest, and a kitchen knife was found in the ground next to the top of her head and was believed to be the murder weapon. It was estimated that the victim had been killed about 4 to 6 weeks before she was found, which would have placed her death sometime during December of 1980. The victim's clothing consisted of Levi's brand blue jeans, white men's Fruit of the Loom cotton briefs, a white long-sleeve shirt with pink, yellow, and blue stripes, a white bra, a beige long-sleeve button-up cardigan sweater with a hood, and a brown leather belt with a large silver buckle that read Buffalo Nickel. She also wore white athletic socks with blue and yellow streaks, and a pair of size 7 Avon Goolagong brand tennis shoes with the names Michael Briscoe, David, Risha, and D. Davies written on them. Investigators could find no record of any missing girls matching the victim's description under the name D. Davies, and were unable to figure out the significance of any of these names. It also appeared that the victim wore braces at one point, since she had traces of bonding residue on her teeth, but it seemed apparent that the braces had either been removed by her or someone who was not a professional orthodontist. Investigators attempted to cross-check the victim with the names of missing girls matching her description, but they were unable to identify her, so her body was kept in storage at a morgue and simply became known as Bossier Doe. Well, in January of 1984, it was announced that notorious serial killer Henry Lee Lucas had confessed to Bossier Doe's murder. According to Lucas, he and his longtime partner in crime, Otis Toole, had picked up a young woman hitchhiking alongside Interstate 45 just north of Dallas, Texas, sometime near Christmas of 1980. When they drove to Bossier Parish, Lucas said that he had sex with the woman before he stabbed her to death, and while he claimed he did not know her true identity, she used the nickname Muffin. In addition to his confession, investigators presented Lucas with a bunch of different knives, and he apparently picked out the correct one, which turned out to be the murder weapon. A Bossier Parish grand jury decided to indict Lucas for Bossier Doe's murder, but he was never extradited there to stand trial, because by that point, he had already been tried and found guilty of numerous murders in Texas. In fact, he was sentenced to death for the 1979 murder of another Jane Doe known only as Orange Socks, though the victim would be identified as Deborah Jackson decades later. Since the Bossier Parish District Attorney's Office expected Lucas to be executed for that crime, they did not believe there was much purpose bringing him to trial for Bossier Doe's murder. While Lucas's execution never went through, he died in prison in March of 2001. But of course, as I'm sure you're well aware, Lucas gained his notoriety by confessing to hundreds of murders he did not commit and recanting his confessions at a later time. Further investigation has since revealed that Lucas was in Florida during the time period Bossier Doe was killed, so he's pretty much been ruled out as a suspect. Around the same time that Lucas's confession made the news, the Louisiana State University Forensic Anthropology and Computer Enhancement Services Laboratory, aka the LSU Faces Lab, decided to use Bossier Doe's skull to create a three-dimensional clay model reconstruction of what her face might have looked like. But even though this image was widely circulated, she still could not be identified. By 2009, technology had advanced so much that the LSU Faces Lab decided to create an all-new digital facial reconstruction for the victim, which was believed to be a lot more accurate. While DNA testing was not an option at the time Bossier Doe's body was originally found, a DNA sample would eventually be extracted from the pulp of her teeth, in hopes of using it to make comparisons to missing people who might be her. By February of 2015, the lead investigator on the case was Lieutenant Shannon Mack of the Bossier Parish Sheriff's Office. She had pretty much hit a dead end in regards to attempting to identify Bossier Doe, so in what she described as a move of quote-unquote pure desperation, Lieutenant Mack decided to create a Bossier Doe Facebook page which contained a lot of important information about the case, including the most recent reconstruction of the victim's face from the LSU Faces Lab. Well, this move paid off in a huge way, because only 6 days after the Facebook page was launched, he was seen by a 911 operator named Linda Erickson. That very same day, Erickson was browsing a Craigslist page from Shreveport, Louisiana, and came across an ad which had been posted for a missing girl named Carol Ann Cole, who had not been seen since December of 1980. The ad contained a photograph of Carol Ann, and Erickson believed she bore such a striking resemblance to the facial construction of Bossier Doe that she contacted the Bossier Parish Sheriff's Office to share this information. Now, if you heard the episode I released last month about the murder of Carolyn Eaton, you might recall how I mentioned a woman named Linda Phelps, who went by the nickname Jeannie. Jeannie lived in Kalamazoo, Michigan, and happened to be the younger sister of Carol Ann Cole, and had not heard from her in 34 years. But while surfing the internet, she happened to come across information about an unidentified Jane Doe named Valentine Sally, who had been found murdered in Coconino County, Arizona, on February the 14th, 1982. Jeannie thought that Valentine Sally might be her missing sister, and since Carol Ann had never officially been reported missing, the Coconino County Sheriff's Office contacted the Kalamazoo Township Police Department in order to have a missing persons report filed for her. They also arranged to have a DNA profile created for Carol Ann by collecting samples from her parents, but it did not match Valentine Sally's DNA. However, it wasn't long before Carol Ann's DNA wound up being matched to another unidentified decedent. Carol Ann and Jeannie were both born in Kalamazoo to parents Sue and Dan Cole, but after their mother and father divorced, the two sisters were primarily raised by their paternal grandmother. In 1979, when she was 15 years old, Carol Ann decided to leave Kalamazoo in order to live with her mother Sue, who was relocating to San Antonio, Texas. But sometime after they arrived, Carol Ann's relationship with her mother seemed to fall apart, as she was apparently very rebellious and often ran away from home. Sue said that they tried counseling to resolve these issues, but when that didn't work, Carol Ann was sent to Austin in May of 1980 and placed in the Peacock Village Home for Girls, which contracted staff from the Palmer Drug Abuse Program. According to her notes in her original file from there, Carol Ann left the home on October the 24th of that year. Sue said she was told by the home that Carol Ann ran away, but since the facility was closing during that time period, it's possible she may have been transferred somewhere. What we do know is that Carol Ann eventually wound up in Shreveport, Louisiana, though the circumstances of how she wound up there are still unknown. During her time in Texas, Carol Ann always remained in constant contact with her sister and grandmother in Michigan, but the last time they heard from her was on December the 13th, 1980, when Carol Ann's grandmother received a collect call from Shreveport. Carol Ann said that she was now staying at a residence on Fairfield Avenue and was babysitting for a family who may have been named Jordan. But after this call, Carol Ann's communication with her family completely ceased. Since Carol Ann's final collect call showed up on her grandmother's phone bill, she eventually decided to phone the number where the call originated from. The individual who answered confirmed that Carol Ann had been staying at the residence, but said that after she left to attend a party, she never came back. Unfortunately, a few years later, a house fire would destroy this phone bill and a lot of the material that Carol Ann's family had collected about her disappearance, so investigators were never able to follow up on many of the leads involving Carol Ann's stay in Shreveport. Sometime in late 1981, the Jordan family apparently sold their home on Fairfield Avenue, and it was later torn down and turned into a business, but no one has ever been able to track this family down and question them about Carol Ann. At the time, Carol Ann's family had no luck convincing law enforcement to perform a proper investigation into her disappearance. Even though Sue Cole told Jeannie that she had filed missing persons reports for Carol Ann with the San Antonio and Shreveport police departments, Jeannie later checked with them and learned they had no record of this. At some point during 1981, Bossier Doe was cross-checked with a list of missing girls from the United States, and Carol Ann's name was on it. But according to notes in the original file, the Bossier Parish coroner ruled Carol Ann out as being the decedent due to what he described as, quote-unquote, numerous differences. Since there was no DNA testing back then, the comparison had to be made with dental records, which were apparently sent to Bossier Parish by Sue, but there's been some confusion about why Carol Ann was excluded as being Bossier Doe. Some sources say that instead of Carol Ann's full x-rays, the coroner only received a dental chart, which marked where her cavities were, which wasn't sufficient enough to make a proper identification. However, in recent years, Sue has claimed that she sent her own dental records to Bossier Parish rather than Carol Ann's, which would explain why they didn't match Bossier Doe. Whatever the case, several years passed without Carol Ann's family receiving any answers about what happened to her, and her paternal grandmother died in 2000. Finally, in 2015, Jeannie's best friend, Patty Thorington, decided to post an ad about Carol Ann's disappearance on a Shreveport-based Craigslist page in an attempt to spread awareness about her case. In an ironic turn of events, Patty mistakenly posted the photo on the sales section of Craigslist rather than the community section, but this is where Linda Erickson happened to see it, on the very same day she saw the facial construction of Bossier Doe from her Facebook page and reported these findings to the authorities. Since a DNA profile had already been constructed for Carol Ann in order to compare her with Valentine Sally, the Bossier Parish Sheriff's Office decided to compare it with the DNA profile of Bossier Doe. Well, on March the 5th, the Sheriff's Office held a press conference in which they announced that the DNA matched and Bossier Doe had now been positively identified as Carol Ann Cole, who would have been 17 years old at the time of her murder. Jeannie was present at the press conference, and following the identification, Carol Ann's remains were cremated, and Jeannie would keep some of her ashes in a silver charm which hung from her necklace. Jeannie also started a GoFundMe page in order to cover the costs of a new headstone for her sister. After the money was raised, Carol Ann was finally given a proper funeral service at Maple Grove Cemetery in Comstock Township, Michigan on June the 18th, which just happened to be the birthday of her late grandmother. A new headstone was placed there which featured Carol Ann's name, as well as the moniker, Bossier's Doe, and the words, quote, "I once was lost, but now am found." The Bossier Parish Sheriff's Office sent flowers to Carol Ann's family for the service and promised to continue searching for her killer. Investigators would now attempt to figure out Carol Ann's movements between when she left Austin in October of 1980 and was murdered sometime in December of that year, as her body was found only 15 miles away from the location where she made her final collect call to her grandmother in Shreveport. Following Carol Ann's identification, Jeannie was given a series of letters that her sister had mailed to her in 1980, but for reasons unknown, they wound up in the possession of their father's former landlord, so this was the first time Jeannie had ever seen them. During these letters, Carol Ann made some disturbing statements about how after she ran away from Texas, she lived with a guy who made her go to bed with his friends. 3 weeks after she moved in with this guy, he threw her out, but even though he took her back 2 days later, he proceeded to physically assault her and punched her so hard that she broke one of her back teeth. However, I do not believe the man mentioned in the letters has ever been identified. Evidence was soon uncovered to suggest that Carol Ann may have spent time at the New Bethany School for Girls, an independent Baptist fundamentalist home where troubled or runaway young girls were sent during the 1970s and 80s. The school was located behind barbed wire fences in a rural area off Louisiana Highway 9 in Arcadia, which is about 50 miles east of Shreveport. The connection was made after a black and white photograph was uncovered, which had been taken at the school sometime in late 1980 and featured a girl sitting in a pew who bore a striking resemblance to Carol Ann. This led to speculation that Carol Ann may have been transferred to the school after the Peacock Village Home for Girls closed down in Austin, but she subsequently ran away from there and wound up in Bossier Parish. The New Bethany School for Girls closed in 2001 and became the subject of controversy after many former residents from the school spoke out and alleged that they were the victims of physical and sexual abuse at the hands of its founder, Mac Ford. After a year-long investigation from the Louisiana State Police, these allegations were heard in front of a grand jury in Bienville Parish, but in January of 2015, they declined to indict Mac Ford, due to the fact that the statute of limitations of these offenses had expired. Ironically enough, Ford died of a heart attack the following month, right around the same time Carol Ann was being identified. One theory is that the names written on Carol Ann's tennis shoes may have been connected to the school, since its residents often have their names written on their clothing and their shoes in marker. Unfortunately, Carol Ann's shoes were no longer available as evidence, since they had been destroyed during a fire at the Bossier Parish Coroner's Office in 2005. A former resident of the school claimed that when she first arrived there, her braces were removed by someone who was not a professional orthodontist. This could have explained the premature removal of Carol Ann's braces from her own teeth, though her mother recalled that Carol Ann removed them herself while she was still living in Texas. However, no evidence has been found in the school's existing files to indicate that Carol Ann ever spent time there in 1980, and investigators are inclined to believe that it has no connection to her murder. According to Shannon Mack, they were able to find additional photographs of the girl who looked like Carol Ann, which were shot from different angles, and their resemblance was not as strong. Well, the most shocking revelation in the investigation would involve the man who found Carol Ann's body, John Chason Sr. On February the 17th, 1997, Chason traveled to Carlos, Louisiana to pay a visit to 74-year-old Lucindy Thibodeau, the former mother-in-law of Chason's estranged wife, Agnes, who had just left him a note indicating her intention to leave him. Even though Agnes was no longer married to Lucindy's son, they continued to maintain a close relationship, so Chason went to see Lucindy and demanded to know where his wife was. However, things escalated to the point where Chason attacked Lucindy and slashed her throat, so he was soon arrested and charged with first-degree murder. It would take 5 years for Chason to go on trial for the crime, since he suffered a heart attack while incarcerated, which required surgery. But in October of 2002, he was finally convicted of second-degree murder and received a sentence of life imprisonment without the possibility of parole at the David Wade Correctional Center. In 2015, John's daughter Frances, who was now going under the surname O'Quinn, came forward to share important information about Carol Ann's case. According to Frances, her father was violent and abusive towards her as she was growing up, and right before he murdered Lucindy, he had informed her that the devil had come to him in a dream and told him to kill someone. When Bossier Doe was identified and Carol Ann's photograph was circulated by the media, Frances became certain that she recognized her as a girl that her father had picked up hitchhiking from a street corner in Shreveport sometime in late 1980. While Frances did not recall her name, she claimed that this girl stayed with her family at their mobile home for about a week, where she helped with the cleaning and even babysat Frances and shared a bed with her. One day, when Frances returned home from school, the girl was gone, but while her father said that the girl's family had stopped by to pick her up, she had left behind a satchel bag she had been carrying, which Frances always found odd. Weeks later, John Sr. suddenly decided to take Frances and her brother, John Jr., out hunting, which she claimed he had never done before. They then drove to the remote logging road next to Highway 157, but when John Sr. parked his truck, he instructed her and John Jr. to walk into the woods in a certain direction, and it wasn't long before they stumbled upon Bossier Doe's body. During a television interview, Frances described the experience by stating, quote, "We panicked, not knowing what it was, screaming. I'm still confused as to where's my dad. Looking back, he's still standing on the road, looking at us," end quote. Since Bossier Doe's face was heavily decomposed, Frances never considered the possibility that she might have been the same girl who stayed at her family's home until she saw Carol Ann's photograph 34 years later and recognized her. He also recalled this girl wearing the same clothing that Carol Ann had worn at the time she was found. In retrospect, Frances now believed that her father may have killed Carol Ann and orchestrated things so that his children would discover her body. When Frances looked at a crime scene photo of the knife which had been stuck in the ground next to the top of Carol Ann's head, she said it remembered a knife she remembered her father keeping on the kitchen counter during that time period. Now, the original police reports only state that John Sr. and John Jr. found the body and make no mention of Frances, but she claims that after her father called the police, he ordered her to stay in the bedroom when they arrived and not talk to them, or else something bad would happen to her. By the time Frances came forward and shared this story, her mother had passed away, but Frances said that she had been out of state during the week the hitchhiker was staying at her family's home and never interacted with her. As for John Chasen Jr., he died by suicide at the age of 42 while living in Arkansas in September of 2008. John Sr. was interviewed in prison multiple times, but denied any involvement in Carol Ann's murder, as well as Francis' story that he had picked up a young female hitchhiker in Shreveport who stayed at his family's home. But even though she was not mentioned in the original police reports, John Sr. did confirm that Francis was present in the woods when they found Carol Ann's body. Francis also took investigators to the spot in Shreveport where she claimed that her father had picked up the hitchhiker, and it turned out to be in close proximity to the residence where Carol Ann made her final phone call to her grandmother. Aside from Francis' story, no direct evidence could be found that John Sr. killed Carol Ann, and he passed away in December of 2016 at the age of 70. While investigators still consider him to be a person of interest, they have stopped short of calling him a suspect. In December of 2021, this case would be profiled on an episode of the Investigation Discovery true crime series Citizen PI. It featured interviews with Jeannie Phelps and her friend Patty Thorington, but surprisingly, they expressed their skepticism that John Chasen Sr. was responsible for Carol Ann's murder. Instead, they directed some suspicion towards Carol Ann's mother, Sue Cole, who was not very proactive about trying to find her daughter when she went missing, which has caused Jeannie and Patty to believe that Sue may know more about Carol Ann's death than she has let on. But this is all just speculation, and after nearly 43 years, there are still no conclusive answers about who killed Carol Ann Cole. So I guess you could say the trail went cold. Anyway, since I covered a similar case on the podcast last month about the 1982 murder of Carolyn Eaton, I'm not going to repeat too many of the talking points I shared on that episode, but it's worth reiterating that DNA testing has been a godsend for allowing so many John and Jane Does to be identified. I mentioned on the Carolyn Eaton episode that for a few years during the 1980s, Valentine Sally was mistakenly identified as a missing girl from Florida who turned out to still be alive, and this identification had been made through the primitive method of comparing photographs of this girl's teeth with the decedent's dental records. We kind of had a reverse situation here, as during the early stages of the investigation, Carol Ann Cole was mistakenly ruled out as being Bossier Doe due to some confusion involving her dental records, but we'll talk more about that momentarily. Of course, since 2018, genetic genealogy has led to the identification of hundreds of decedents, but even though DNA testing allowed for the identification of Bossier Doe, that took place 3 years before genetic genealogy became a crime-solving tool. This was an example of the right pieces falling into place at the right time, because an online sleuth just happened to visit Bossier Doe's Facebook page and see a Craigslist ad for Carol Ann Cole's disappearance on the exact same day and became convinced they were the same person. And I have to say that the updated facial reconstruction that the LSU Faces Lab created for Bossier Doe in 2009 is one of the most accurate I've ever seen, because when you compare it to photographs of Carol Ann, the resemblance is uncanny. However, it wasn't always this way. The LSU Faces Lab made their first attempt at a facial reconstruction in 1984 and created a clay model of Bossier Doe's head, but if you look at the photographs of it from that time period, the resemblance is not uncanny. In fact, the clay reconstruction is actually quite frightening and almost makes her look like some haggard witch from a horror movie. So this just goes to show you how much technology and cold case investigations have evolved these past several decades and why I love covering these older cases on this podcast. So much like Carolyn Eaton and many other cases from this time period involving murdered decedents, Carol Ann Cole was a runaway and was found dead in a state where she did not live, which would explain why it took so long to identify her. And of course, law enforcement was a lot less receptive to doing missing persons investigations for runaway teenagers during the early 1980s. A lot of the time, it was assumed that these decedents were loners who did not have family members who cared about them, but that was definitely not the case with Carol Ann, as her paternal grandmother and her sister Jeannie really wanted to find out what happened to her, but often felt powerless to do anything. But now that Carol Ann has finally been identified, the big mystery is figuring out who killed her, and there's still a lot of missing pieces to the puzzle of how she wound up in Bossier Parish to begin with. Even though she originally hailed from Michigan, Carol Ann had spent about a year living in Texas with her mother and at the Peacock Village Home for Girls, but sometime after October of 1980, she made an over 300-mile trip from Austin to Shreveport, Louisiana, for unknown reasons. The reason we know so much about her movements in Texas is because following Carol Ann's identification in 2015, Jeannie unearthed some long-lost letters her sister had sent to her in the months prior to her death, and according to Jeannie, a lot of the details in these letters contradicted stories that her mother Sue had shared with her for years, as Sue apparently never mentioned that she sent Carol Ann to the Peacock Village Home for Girls. Sue has claimed that she was told by the home that Carol Ann ran away from there, and when this case was featured on an episode of the true crime show Crime Watch Daily in 2015, Sue agreed to be interviewed and said that Carol Ann did phone her after she arrived in Shreveport. While Sue maintained that she told Carol Ann that she was welcome to come back home if she wanted to, it sounds like Jeannie has since developed some skepticism about her mother's version of events, but we'll get back to this later on. During these letters that Jeannie uncovered, Carol Ann wrote about living with a guy after she left Austin who physically abused her and eventually kicked her out. Under normal circumstances, this guy might seem like a very promising suspect in her murder, but unfortunately, no other details were shared about him, so there really isn't much to go on. All we do know is that Carol Ann made at least one phone call to her family from Shreveport, where she claimed that she was living with and babysitting for a family named Jordan, but they later told Carol Ann's grandmother that she left their residence to attend a party and never came back. Once again, you could assume that this family potentially played a role in Carol Ann's murder, but since they were never tracked down or questioned, we have no further details to go on. Aside from Francis O'Quinn, it does not sound like investigators have been able to find any witnesses who recall having seen or interacted with Carol Ann in Shreveport or Bossier Parish in 1980. So before we start exploring more logical theories, we have to at least discuss the potential involvement of Henry Lee Lucas, who not only confessed to Carol Ann's murder, but was even indicted for the crime as well. I have probably mentioned Henry Lee Lucas's name more than any other serial killer on this podcast, not because I have a great desire to talk about him, but because if I cover any crimes which occurred in the southern United States during the late 1970s or early 1980s, there's a better than average chance that Lucas confessed to them at some point. And of course, this was all made possible by a number of law enforcement agencies who were anxious to get some unsolved homicides off their books and were more than happy to let Lucas take the rap for them, even if there was no corroborating evidence besides his own confessions. It's been reported that Lucas shared details about Carol Ann's murder that only the killer should have known, and even managed to pick out the correct knife, which was the murder weapon, but we now know that investigators often fed Lucas details about these crimes before he confessed to them. It's also worth noting that in addition to this crime, Lucas was also indicted by a Bossier Parish grand jury for the murder of 48-year-old Dolly Dement, who was found next to some railroad tracks in Bossier City on October the 29th, 1978. Once again, the only real evidence against Lucas was his own confession, and he was never extradited to Bossier Parish to stand trial for Carol Ann or Dolly's murders. Lucas admitted that his main motivation for falsely confessing to all these crimes throughout the United States is that it would give him the opportunity to leave prison and travel to all these locations and be granted special privileges. So this would explain why he would confess to a pair of murders from Louisiana he had nothing to do with while he was incarcerated in Texas. By the time Lucas was implicated in these two cases, he had already been convicted for a number of murders in Texas and sitting on death row, so since it appeared he was going to die anyway, Bossier Parish authorities figured there was no point spending a bunch of taxpayer money on additional trials. I mentioned earlier that the only crime Lucas was ever sentenced to death for was the murder of a Jane Doe whose nude body was found in Williamson County, Texas on October the 31st, 1979. I already covered this case on episode number 93 of the podcast, but since the victim was only clad in a pair of orange socks, that became her nickname for 40 years until DNA testing positively identified her as 23-year-old Deborah Jackson in August of 2019. You can make a number of parallels between Lucas's confessions to the murders of Deborah and Carol, because in both cases, he claimed he had picked them up hitchhiking and only knew them by a nickname they had supposedly shared with him, Joni in Deborah's case and Muffin in Carol Ann's case. But of course, the big controversy surrounding Lucas's conviction for Deborah Jackson's murder is that there was pretty convincing evidence placing him hundreds of miles away in Florida on the date she was killed. So even though Lucas was definitely a murderer who belonged behind bars, there was something very unethical about executing him for a crime he clearly did not commit. So then Texas Governor George W. Bush agreed to commute Lucas's death sentence to life imprisonment before he died of natural causes a few years later. And it sounds like the same issue has plagued this case, as there is apparently evidence to show that Lucas was in Florida during the time period he said that he killed Carol Ann. So long story short, I'm pretty sure this is yet another example of Henry Lee Lucas leading law enforcement on a wild goose chase, and I don't think he had anything to do with this crime. So another potential lead in this case is that Carol Ann wound up at the New Bethany School for Girls in Arcadia, and this somehow played a role in her death. This place was an absolute horror show when it came to rampant systemic abuse of young girls, and you can probably put together an entire podcast series about this topic. The main reason there's been speculation that Carol Ann was at the New Bethany School is because of the unearthed photograph from there, which was taken sometime in 1980 and shows a young girl sitting on a pew who does bear a striking resemblance to her. Well, the official story seems to be that Carol Ann ran away from the Peacock Village Home for Girls in late October of that year. The facility was closing down during that time period anyway, so if they needed a place to ship some of their troubled girls, perhaps Carol Ann was transferred to New Bethany. Jeannie always believed that her mother has not been entirely truthful about certain aspects of this case, so theoretically, if Sue did consent for Carol Ann to be sent to New Bethany, but then later learned about the horrific abuse which took place there, Sue might have been too ashamed or embarrassed to admit that she allowed her daughter to wind up there. However, even though this idea has not been completely ruled out, it sounds like investigators are inclined to believe that Carol Ann did not go to New Bethany, as despite that photograph, there is nothing in the files to indicate that she was ever there. I know it's tempting to believe that Carol Ann may have been killed as a result of abuse she experienced at the school, but the problem is that it was documented that she made at least one collect phone call from a number in Shreveport, which is over 50 miles away from Arcadia. If Carol Ann was at New Bethany at some point, this call seems to indicate that she would have either been released from there or escaped and ran away. And I find it more likely that Carol Ann would be murdered by someone she crossed paths with in Shreveport, rather than someone from New Bethany going to the trouble of traveling there in order to track Carol Ann down and kill her. One reason it was speculated that Carol Ann was at New Bethany is because the residents were apparently required to write their names on their clothing and shoes, and Carol Ann had a number of names written on her shoes when she was found. But I'm not sure this is a relevant comparison, because New Bethany residents were told to write their own names, whereas completely different names, such as Michael Briscoe, David, Risha, and Dee Davies, were on Carol Ann's shoes. As far as I can tell, this is still an unresolved aspect of this case, as I don't believe investigators have ever found anyone under those names with a known connection to Carol Ann. For all we know, perhaps Michael Briscoe, or David, or Dee Davies might be the name of this abusive guy that Carol Ann mentioned in her letters. But if any of these individuals could be identified or interviewed, they might provide some insight into Carol Ann's whereabouts during that 2-month window of time when she is unaccounted for. Regardless of who the killer was, it seems very likely that Carol Ann was murdered sometime in mid to late December of 1980, since she was estimated to have been dead at least 4 to 6 weeks when her body was found in January of 1981. And that leads us to the person who is most suspected of being responsible for her death, and that's John Chasen Sr. Now, I have to admit that when I first became familiar with this case, I instantly believed that Chason was the perpetrator, as it seemed like quite a coincidence that he would discover Carol Ann's body and then go to prison for another murder 2 decades later. However, when I watched the Citizen PI episode, which aired in 2021, I was quite surprised to see Jeannie and her friend, Patty Thorington, express their belief that Chason did not kill Carol Ann and that his daughter, Frances O'Quinn, was not credible. Admittedly, the only evidence that Chason had any contact with Carol Ann prior to her death is Frances's word, as she claimed that her father picked up Carol Ann hitchhiking and let her stay with his family for a week before she abruptly disappeared. And anyone else who could corroborate Frances's story, such as her mother and her brother, John Jr., are now deceased. I know it's become a bit of a cliche in true crime circles that killers sometimes like to return to the scene of their crimes, and even be the person who reports said crime to the authorities. This is exactly what Frances believes happened, as she said that her father made the very unusual decision to take her and her brother hunting, and lo and behold, they wound up stumbling across Carol Ann's body very quickly, while John Sr. just hung back at his truck. Based on a recollection of his behavior, Frances believed that her father knew exactly what he was doing, and if she's being truthful, it's incredibly messed up that he would intentionally subject his children to the trauma of finding a victim who he had killed. But since Frances described her father as being violent and abusive while she was growing up, it sounds like this sort of thing would be par for the course for someone like him. If police believed he was involved in the murder, John Sr. could simply say, "Do you honestly think I would intentionally do something like this to my own children?" In a sense, if John Sr. orchestrated everything this way, then his strategy did technically work, as I do not think he was ever considered to be a person of interest until after Carol Ann was identified 34 years later. During her Citizen PI interview, Patty said she did not consider Frances' account to be credible because there were a number of inconsistencies in her story. For instance, the original police reports do not mention Frances being at the scene for the discovery of Carol Ann's body, but Frances' explanation for this is that her father ordered her not to speak to the police or tell them she had been there. Frances also apparently claimed that she stood in Carol Ann's chest cavity when she found her body, but Patty said that the original autopsy report refutes this. However, the lead investigator, Shannon Mack, was also interviewed on Citizen PI, and she said she personally believes that Frances is not lying, and given that she's a police officer who often deals with people who lie, this does hold some weight. Mack also says that when she asked Frances to point out the spot in Shreveport where her father picked up Carol Ann hitchhiking, it was near the location where Carol Ann made her final phone call to her grandmother, a piece of information which Frances could not have known at that time. If Carol Ann had been babysitting for a family in Shreveport, but decided she wanted to move on for some reason, it makes sense that she would attempt to hitch a ride and possibly accept Chason's offer to stay at his mobile home. From the interviews I've seen with Frances, I do think she sounds sincere when she's sharing her story, and if there were inconsistencies, this may have something to do with the fact that she suffered through an abusive childhood and may have repressed some of her memories due to the trauma. After all, Frances didn't even consider the possibility that the body she found was the same girl who had stayed at her home until she saw Carol Ann's photo 34 years later. But even if Frances is telling the truth, could her memory of this girl still be reliable after all that time? If Chason was guilty of this murder, you may be wondering why he would direct his children to find Carol Ann in the first place, since there was nothing else to tie him to her death, and given that her body had remained undiscovered in that remote location for weeks, it's possible she never would have been found if he did not do this. Frances's theory is that her father may have had a guilty conscience about the whole thing, but made a calculated decision not to inform the authorities until after the decomposition rendered her unrecognizable. Chason also denied any involvement in the murder until his own death, even though he was already serving a life sentence without the possibility of parole, and had nothing to lose by confessing. But as we've already seen with people like Henry Lee Lucas, convicted murderers will often toy with the authorities when they're behind bars by either confessing to crimes they didn't commit or refusing to confess their involvement in other crimes they did commit. I think the main reason that Jeannie and Patty are skeptical of Chason's involvement is because they have their own suspicions about Sue Cole. I don't believe they think Sue personally killed Carol Ann per se, as she was living in Texas, and there's nothing to indicate that she traveled all the way to Louisiana to commit murder. But Jeannie feels her mother may know more about Carol Ann's death than she has ever let on, and has always been bothered about the lack of urgency Sue displayed about the disappearance of her daughter. Sue apparently never filed any missing persons report for Carol Ann, and she actually moved from Texas back to Michigan in 1981. While Sue said that she did this to care for her own dying mother, who later passed away of cervical cancer, Jeannie still found it strange that she would do this without finding out what happened to Carol Ann. I think the most troubling discrepancy is that Sue failed to provide the proper dental records to the Bossier Parish Coroner's Office, which is why Carol Ann was mistakenly ruled out as being Bossier Doe. The big aha moment in the Citizen PI episode is a phone conversation where Sue tells Jeannie that she sent her own dental records to the authorities in 1981 rather than Carol Ann's. That would certainly explain why she wasn't properly identified, but this seems like a very odd misunderstanding, because why would Sue believe that the coroner needed her own dental records? This is why Jeannie and Patty suspected that Sue may have sent the wrong dental records on purpose to prevent the identification. But if so, what is she trying to hide? Given that Carol Ann was primarily raised by her paternal grandmother, I get the impression that she never had the closest relationship with her own mother, so perhaps the lack of urgency and emotion that Sue displayed about Carol Ann's disappearance and death may be the result of indifference rather than outright complicity. In spite of these misgivings about Sue, I still personally believe that John Chason being Carol Ann's killer is the most logical theory. Due to the level of decomposition on Carol Ann's body, I'm not sure if it could be determined if she was sexually assaulted, but if Francis's story is truthful, Chason may have taken Carol Ann out to that remote section of the woods, possibly to assault her, and then proceeded to stab her there 9 times. And then, several weeks later, he arranged things for Francis and John Jr. to discover the body so he could report it to the authorities. But I do acknowledge that other than Francis's account, there is no direct evidence to implicate Chason, which is why he was only named as a person of interest by law enforcement rather than a full-fledged suspect. Shannon Mack has stated that in her gut, she does feel that Chason had something to do with the murder, but without any conclusive evidence, she still has to explore alternate possibilities. Since Chason is now deceased, and I don't believe there was any of the killer's DNA found at the murder scene, it may be hard to link him to this crime after all these years. If Chason was the killer, it is sad that he wound up murdering another victim, Lucindy Thibodeau, but at least it meant he got to spend the last 2 decades of his life in prison. I'm glad that Carol Ann finally got her name back after 34 years, and her family received some answers about what happened to her, but this case is not going to be completely resolved unless we can prove who was responsible for her death. So if you happen to have any information on the murder of Carol Ann Cole, please contact the Bossier Parish Sheriff's Office at 318-965-2203. That's 318-965-2203. But if you just have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Another reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. Over the past 5 years, our Patreon page has released dozens of exclusive bonus episodes, which are all currently available in our archives. This past month, for our patrons in tiers 2 and 3, I released a follow-up to a popular Patreon episode I released last year, where I discuss my top 10 favorite movies inspired by true crimes. I've also dropped an exclusive bonus episode from my spin-off podcast, The Path Went Chilly, in which myself and my two co-hosts, Jules and Ashley, discuss the 1985 disappearance of George Owens. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've recorded another new audio commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries, and we now have over 50 of these commentary tracks in our archives. I'd also like to give a shout-out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon this week, and they are Lindsay L., Tanya C., and Lee Pete. Thank you so much for your support. The Trail Went Cold will be appearing on Podcast Row at CrimeCon, which is being held from September the 22nd to the 24th at the World Center Marriott in Orlando, Florida. Our podcast has a specialized promo code which can be used to get a special 10% discount on tickets, so in order to do so, please visit crimecon.com and use the promo code COLD23. That's COLD23. I just wanted to give another shout-out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online Forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the ear music here on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. Anyway, next week, I will be traveling to Austin, Texas to appear at the True Crime Podcast Festival, which takes place at the DoubleTree by Hilton Hotel from August the 25th to the 27th. Per tradition, whenever I attend one of these podcasting events, I always like to cover a case from the host city during the same week the event takes place. Well, you probably noticed that Austin, Texas was briefly mentioned during today's episode, but next week, I will be profiling what is probably the most famous cold case in the history of Austin, and it's going to be part one of a special two-part series about the Austin Yogurt Shop murders. So until then, have yourselves a great week, and join us next Wednesday for the start of a brand new series of episodes on The Trail Went Cold. We'll be right back.